Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Burning down the house here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Today we're going to continue our ongoing intermittent series of discussions about passive house construction. Those of you who are civilians may not be conversant with that. It's an approach. It's almost a philosophy, but there is also a set of fairly stringent rules that go along with how to build a house whose goal is to be as airtight as possible, and therefore, so the idea is, to use as little energy as possible. Not no energy, but very little energy, and therefore mostly electrical energy, because we can control that in very discreet increments. Joining us today in studio is Gennaro Brooks Church from Eco Brooklyn. Have I got that? Is that right? Right. He's a builder, and he is very green. He's a very good green guy. He's actually turned me on to Black Locust, and I've now become a Black Locust, not only an aficionado, but an exponent, and now we're going to use that in a bunch of our projects. Through also a referral, I got to know Stubby Wormbold at City Logs. And so, hello, say hello.
Hi there.
Is he lit? Say hello again.
Hello.
So much better. Gennaro has recently completed a row house in Harlem on, is it East or West 130th Street?
West.
West 130th. So just up there beyond Morningside Heights, just above the massive land holdings of Columbia University. And what piqued my interest at first was Gennaro saying that he had done this using three triple zero criteria, construction materials, no waste, and no energy. I guess maybe that's a goal, yeah?
It's definitely a goal. It's a hard one to reach, but
I would say...
We get closer, though.
Really? Okay.
Job, yeah.
Well, here are a few things in no particular order that I want to talk about. Then we'll have a little break, and you can frame your thoughts, and then we can dive into it. I want to talk about passive house and financial reality, because if you're bidding on a project, you have to be competitive. Thought only goes so far, although I think most, from my experience as an architect, most owners weigh their decision very heavily on whether they think they can work with the builder. You know, are you like-minded? So, you know, that's a plus. But it does come down to being able to be within a range of 8 to 10% of competitive total cost in order to really convince an owner. So that's one. Two, the availability of materials and technologies in metropolitan New York right now, what your experience has been with that. And also your own feelings about comfort. One of the goals of passive house is that it's a very comfortable environment. Now, most of the passive house construction in the world are very small projects. There are a few commercial projects, but nothing really, really large. It's still an emerging philosophy and approach to technology. It only goes back to the early 1990s in Germany. So that's not very long when we look at the history of building, which is fine because most architects, most of you who are practicing architects out there, most of you are in the realm of small projects. There are very few of us actually who work on very large projects. It's just the way that the world goes. And as we amble along in our conversation, I'm sure that other thoughts will come up. Jack, let's have our first little meditation on how everything counts. I'm here with Curtis B. Wayne on Burning Down the House with Gennaro Brooks Church. We're talking about this new world of passive house construction. in which we attempt to make houses that are as airtight as possible with a very, very low amount of exfiltration or infiltration. And then instead of cracking a window to get fresh air, there are wonderful new technologies that will ventilate the house continually and also recover heat for the heating season. So what was the first talk? Pick a talking point, yeah. And let's just launch into it.
I took notes. You got the first point was the cost.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this material, I'm reading in a blog about Gennaro's project, and it's like, and you can use Caflex or Roflex EPDM gaskets, or you can use Tescon number one, and all this stuff. Well, aside from it looks like it's all, a lot of it's tapes, and we know about tape. And tape these days is mostly from polyester, which mostly comes from petroleum products. And so long term, I have my misgivings about being an advocate for using materials that rely on oil, because I truly believe that in 40 years, oil is going to be done. And if we can't grow it and process it with electricity, because I don't think electricity is going away, then we're up a creep.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that there were the ceiling with the caulking and the taping and all that stuff. Definitely, that's what defines passive house for me.
Sure,
it's the defining point, and it's so in terms of cost, it's these tapes. On that particular project, for example, we must have spent thousands of dollars on tape. When in a normal project, your normal contractor would, I'd be surprised if they spent even a couple $100 on tape. I mean, for what? You know, it's just not used. Painter's tape, maybe.
Yeah.
So right. That was a huge expense. And the discussion was, well, why can't we just go with your cheap 3M
right
tape and the
yeah, why not? You know, like duct tape, right?
Right. Well, the people who are selling us the expensive German tape will tell us that it'll last a lot longer than the duct tape, and I think they're right. But your point is, I think, part of a larger point.
Yeah. Well, that's one thread. Anyone who says that a tape is going to keep its adhesion for 50 years cannot possibly know, because we haven't had time to test it.
Yeah.
So that's one aspect. I mean, so there's this notion that these tapes will perform better than, say, a spray polyurethane foam. Let's set aside outgassing for a moment, which we know shrinks a little bit, but we also know from polyurethane glues like Gorilla Glue, it's very tenacious. You know, it's very sticky. So, but let's go back to the financial side. I mean, so this stuff is really expensive. So you really had to sell the program.
The thing, a passive house is kind of like a fancy car, and that's one of one of its downfalls is that fancy cars are expensive to build, and they're also like racehorses. You know, they can fail. You know, you stick a hole in a passive house, and the whole thing falls apart. I mean, it's really, really based on the fact that you've got this well-sealed envelope.
Well, you mean it ceases to be a passive house, and then it's just an ordinary house.
Yeah, I guess doesn't fall up.
The whole concept of the super airtight enclosure.
Or the concept that you're not using very much heat.
Right.
All of a sudden, you're going to get cold. So, This is stuff that you, in terms of pricing, you're selling them on something that's, if you maintain it, which takes education and no stupid electrician, you know, banging through the walls, that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
they will have next to nothing in terms of utility bills. So you can, if they, in terms of an investment, there's going to be a large return on their investment if they build a passive house. And that's how you frame it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, if they can afford it, it is more upfront. But over the life of the house, it's definitely cheaper than your typical house. And then, of course, you're not even talking about the comfort.
Well, and that makes a lot of sense in the context of a trend of people to invest in a house and stay put. About a month ago, another guest that I had was Dua Dickinson. He's written a book that's getting a lot of play on Amazon.com called Staying Put, where he talks about a trend of investing for something that you're going to live in instead of the paradigm over the last many years and decades of get into a house, flip it, move up, flip it, take the money, retire, downsize. That's not going to work for a long time, as far as we can tell, going forward. So if a project like the one that you've just completed has got a real life cycle benefit, then people who understand that they're going to stay in a place for a while would be willing to invest in that.
Yeah, and I think that's a larger picture. I haven't read that book. It sounds interesting, but I think ever since 9/11, people have started nesting. You know, I mean, you can see in the birth rates, you know, the amount of births after 9/11 increased, the amount of marriages. People were like hunkering down, and then they were hit with the economy, and I think that it makes a lot of sense. This book that you mentioned, it makes a tremendous amount of sense, and mm-hmm. that you just can't buy and flip anymore.
No.
It's just not there.
No,
you know, so. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then the other thing that I'm noticing with clients is that they're looking at their money as not so much the free money that it was. You know,
that's for sure.
It's now it's hard earned, and they want to maximize it. And all of a sudden, green building is a selling point. Expensive green building. Mm-hmm. It's a selling point from the point of view that they're getting the maximum value for their dollar. They're not getting a crap house. And they're willing to pay a little bit more for that because they're thinking long term now.
Yeah, not a crap house. I have to write that down. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, there were.
Sorry.
You no. You can trademark that.
I did. I'm on the computer now.
Yeah. Okay. Got that. Not a crap house. I love that. Oh God, I have so many questions. So we have these high tech tapes, and we have these gaskets, and starting to understand that one of the primary aspects of what you do in passive house construction is to make the insulation, the insulative cocoon, totally airtight on both faces, the inside and the outside. Now, in terms of making it work on the inside, now that's a real problem. I mentioned before we went on the air, Greg Lavadera, who was a guest of ours. You might want to look him up. He was a few episodes ago. His approach to making the inside face airtight is to create a service layer. He'll do the air barrier on the inside and then have furring in which coax and power cable and piping are run, and then over which then the finish sheetrock goes. And that seems to make a certain amount of sense if you can spare that super thick assembly of the outside wall.
Yeah, like 6 inches, yeah.
Well, he mostly deals in single-family houses, so your worst case really is a depth of a back box for an electric outlet.
Right.
So that's like 2.5-3 inches, depending on overall, from back of face to outside sheetrock, right? Because almost any other kind of piping that you're likely to have in a passive house is going to be small. It would be maybe domestic water in the wall, but certainly no waste in the wall. You'd do that in stacks, but you wouldn't have any heating piping because you don't have radiators because the house is self-warming. And you probably wouldn't have line sets for a split AC unit because you wouldn't need it most of the time. So this project, although you're not going for certification, meets the Passive House standard for airtightness. What is that?
Well, it's in this case, we got 0.75. So, you know.
And what is that?
Air changes per hour.
Wow.
And so it's really very tight. But the one of the things that we've learned in this job in terms of the heating and the cooling is that, yes, we don't need very much. Each there's three apartments. One's a duplex. There's then the two floor throughs. Each unit needs a mini split, just a little one ton mini split.
Okay.
And that does the heating and the cooling.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And the problem with a passive house is that it needs so little, it's not justifiable to pass all this ductwork everywhere just for like a little tiny thing. So what we have is we have one blower unit in the middle of the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've learned is that it's so crucial where that blower unit is because all your eggs are in one basket, so to speak. So there's very minimal, if any, cold air coming from the exterior walls, the windows and the doors.
Yeah.
So you can get away with something in a normal house, which would be very inefficient, which is hot blown air.
Mm-hmm.
But in a passive house, you can get away with that because there's very little cold that you got to get rid of. So you're essentially just kind of supplementing the heat that's coming off the people's bodies and the stoves and
lighting, know, sure.
Lighting,
although
exactly.
Increasingly that'll be less as LEDs get more efficient.
Yeah.
Right. Your emphasis on heat amuses me a little bit because that's a Central European emphasis where they don't have they have not previously had very hot summers. But from my point of view, looking at the history of New York City, when in previous centuries, when people of means could escape the city in the summer, they did. So cooling was, to my mind, at least as much of a concern as heating. I mean, the old buildings that we retrofit, like you are retrofitting, have a lot of thermal mass in the outside wall, so they are inherently efficient for holding in heat, even if they're 18th or 19th century technology. And before we had super tight windows, there were drapes to stop drafts. So I guess what you're saying is by using a heat pump, you get that cooling happening. And you just simply don't allow the volume to get all that hot.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But that means that you must have had to put a lot of insulation on the roof to keep the insulation, the solar heat gain from building up too much and cooking the people upstairs.
Yeah, yeah. The front and back walls actually surprisingly didn't need that much. I mean, the calculations we came up with are basically code for New York City, which is around R20.
Uh-huh.
So it's really not that much. We went, just to be safe, we salvaged all our insulation, and so it was a little cheaper than most, and so we were just like, let's just throw a little bit more in there. But the ceiling, we couldn't mess around with, and we put, I think, like 12 inches of polyiso.
Wow.
And then another 10 inches of cellulose. We went pretty crazy on the ceiling. And the reason, of course, is that just so much heat and
12 cold. Inches of poly, that's like R60 or something.
It turned out to be close to R100, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot. But and one interesting thing I learned is that if you've got wooden studs versus metal studs, the heat loss through the metal studs is close to 80%.
Sure.
Whereas with the wood, it's 3%. So essentially, it's a complete waste of time to insulate between metal. You've got to insulate above it or below it.
Yes. Or beyond the surface of it. Right.
Yeah.
Because it's a perfect conductor.
And the amount of buildings I have seen with insulation and people just kind of presuming it's the same as metal or, you know, not even thinking about it, in New York City is insane.
Yeah, but there's a substantial labor savings in using cold form metal. I mean, you know, zip it together with a screw gun instead of having to nail things and anchor them. But when you're working with a legacy structure, and you know, for small buildings, we can still use wood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other thing on the party walls, we didn't insulate at all. And so the neighbors, we're counting that the neighbors will not start smoking crack and, like, you know, not pay their heating bill. So as long as they don't do that, then you're fine. I mean, you're presuming they're human and they like similar temperatures to you.
Although you did seal the walls for air tightness.
That's a good point, yeah. Now one thing that's... I took the passive house training. I really, really studied it deeply. And the one issue I have is the justification that it's okay to buy new materials because the life of the house has so much energy savings that the embodied energy you put into the house at the beginning is justified.
I dig that. Let's get to that in the next segment. Let's have a little break.
Okay.
Changing your heart. Oh. house before the car. Those teenage hopes who have tears in their eyes, too scared to run after one little while. Oh, oh, the change in his heart. Oh, oh, you know who you are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10. Money can't buy you back the love that you had then.
Heritage Radio. Here's a note from Jimmy Carboni of Beer Sessions, proprietor of Jimmy's number 43 at 43 East 7th Street. Heritage Radio Network salutes shows that have reached the 100th episode on March 21st, just this next Wednesday, at Santos Party House. Heritage Radio Network hosts will come out, including myself. You should come.
Okay.
To celebrate, and the party is open to the public. Beer Sessions Radio will be there because there will be also some amazing artisanal spirits, craft beers, wine, cheese, chocolate, and charcuterie, along with the Heritage Radio Network superstars and some of the most innovative voices in food and drink today, and may I say, also design, architecture, and the creative arts. It's going to be a great night, so get your tickets today. For more information, follow the link on the Heritage Radio Network page, www.heritageradionetwork.com.
When is that?
Next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday.
At Santos House. And it will support programming here on the Heritage Radio Network. It's from 7 to 10 at Santos House, which is in North Chinatown on Lafayette Street. I've never been there, but I'm really looking forward to it. I will be there. Several of my former guests have said that they will make an appearance, and they are buying tickets at $50 a ticket. It's a great deal. It will be fantastic food, and I'm absolutely sure that the adult beverages will be amazing if you are of that inclination. If not, I'm sure there will be fizzy water and artisanal
cheese.
Tap water and cheese. There will be artisanal cheese, absolutely. One thing you can guarantee is that when the Heritage Radio Network tribe gets together, it is good food and good drink. Everything counting down all of the possible ways to make the optimal project that gets around to your 000 goal.
Right.
So the embodied energy you were talking about.
Yeah. The general premise with Passive House is that the amount of embodied energy to create a Passive House is very justified because it uses so little energy once it's built.
Sure.
Which is great.
So you've got a trade-off.
Right.
Right. The materials that go in have embodied energy over the life cycle of the house, and you can hope that your project will have a life cycle of at least 80 years before it needs major renovation.
Yeah.
Therefore, it beats the effort in having to find reclaimed materials or.
Well, see, that's the problem I see. It's like, I don't think a lot of people have actually gone there. They're just like, it's justified. You know, let's just keep moving.
It's an article of faith.
Yeah, it's, and I don't. I have a bit of an issue with that because my sense in the core definition of green building for me is not to build at all. And so,
totally agree.
Yeah, you know, it's like military intelligence. It's a bit of an oxymoron. So. For me, salvage is still king, and so what I tried to do in this job as a first time job was, and succeeded, I think, for the most
part. First time Passive House job.
Well, for the first time we combined Passive House with our goal of 100% salvage materials.
Okay,
and which is a first. I don't know of any building that's done that.
Nor do I.
Yeah, so I it was really a success.
So how much did you successfully salvage from what had been there?
Well, let me put it this way. There was, once the building was done, there was less garbage in the landfill than when it was before it existed.
Were you able to spin off your waste to someone who could recycle your waste, or no?
Well, your typical brownstone when it's constructed, I'm just making this up kind of from experience.
That's fine.
I would say let's just say the shape of the brownstone is about what garbage is created in the construction of it. So, you know, after a brownstone's built, you can say about that size of mass is in the garbage.
Really?
In terms of
25 feet by 75 feet high by 60 feet deep, a cube of that of garbage is what you generate? Wow.
I'd say it's not uncommon for a renovation to go through, I don't know, nine dumpsterfuls.
A dumpster at, 10 cubic yards or something?
No, 20.
20 cubic
yards. They go through them like crazy. And that's, 10 or 8 feet by 20 feet? So it's definitely up there. So what our goal was to just not go there. So we had it easy in the sense that it was a fire-gutted brownstone.
Okay, I was going to ask you, what condition it was in.
I mean, you could see the pigeons in the sky when you walked in.
Okay.
So there was very little to take out. And so that was a little bit like cheating.
Excuse your results.
Exactly. So the triple zero bottom line, I guess, what I call zero brownstone construction, or zero construction, zero building construction.
Yeah.
In this case, it's zero brownstone. Is, first of all, when you're renovating it, before you renovate it, you're demolishing what's there. You know, you're taking out the garbage. None of that garbage goes to the landfill. So you find a use for it somewhere else.
Okay.
Then when you're building it, you're not buying any new materials.
That's your goal.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
And then the final product creates zero waste in terms of sewage or, you know, the stuff coming out. So you've got composting toilets, gray water, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And consumes zero offsite energy. So then you've got solar panels.
Well, right now we have a little problem with composting toilets in New York City because city really wants you to be able to get rid of your sludge. How do you do that, you know, in a three-unit apartment? That could be a little touchy.
Yeah, well, the way we dealt with that is first we applied for legally putting in a composting system.
And you got a permit for that.
We got denied.
Uh-huh.
We got shut down real quick.
Okay.
Their reason was completely uneducated. They didn't know what the hell they were talking about. It was clearly off the map for them.
It is.
They're just like, don't even. Go away.
Yeah.
You know. So what we did was we plumbed all the toilets on a different drain than the other drains.
And you were allowed to do that. You were allowed to recapture gray water.
No, you're allowed to do your plumbing however the hell you want. If you want, you can run a separate line for every sink and every toilet. And they just think it's stupid financially, but you're allowed to legally do it. So we ran a drain for all the toilets separately from the drains from the kitchen and the bathrooms.
And sinks and showers.
Correct.
Right. So that in the future,
correct,
if they want to capture or they're allowed to capture gray water, they could.
Or black water. So it's plumbed so that you can just pop in a 3200 series Sunmar central composting unit, for example, in the cellar.
And what does that do? Is that a black water processor?
Well, no, it's a composting system. So it would take all the runoff from the toilets and compost it. And once every 4 or 5 months, you'd have a little bucket of compost that you could put in your backyard and grow vegetables with, and it's totally fine.
In the world of big construction, that's a black water processing facility. The buildings at Battery Park City, the new ones, all have their own black water, their own sewage processing systems, and they end up with sludge, but it's processed sludge. It doesn't necessarily self-compost the way that you're describing. It's treated the way that the city treats their sewage, with aeration and sedimentation, and it's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's several different tanks. So what's the name of that again?
Oh, the one I was talking about.
Sunar?
Sunmar. Clevis Multrum and Sunmar are the two ones. Like, the Bronx Zoo is all composting toilets by Clevis Multrum.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those have been around since the late 60s, I believe.
Yeah, these are all from the experimentation that happened in the 70s, early 70s. Yeah,
but they're a zoo, so they can experiment with composting toilets, I guess.
They're big.
So
anyway,
that had a financial aspect.
It did and it didn't. I mean, the mistake I made was to feel that since I was salvaging almost everything, in the sense that the joists, the subfloors, the floors, the studs, the sheetrock, the insulation, all of it was salvaged. Like, it's on its way to the dump, we turned the truck around and we said, bring it to our house. So massive
salvage from other projects
or dumpsters or our own jobs or
talked about that earlier, that there should be a common Twitter account where people who are dumpster divers could just tweet like 261 Moore Street, there's really great shit in front of Roberta's with the time, and people would just come by and
I agree,
pick it away. So you salvage not from this particular site, but from other sites.
Yeah, because this site didn't have much to offer. It had been rained on for 10 years, and before then there was a fire.
How do you arrange such a salvage operation?
Well, those are the logistics that Eco Brooklyn is really working hard on, because I feel that going to define success or failure. If you get the logistics of salvage down, I think it's scalable to any level. You can do a skyscraper. You can do a back shed. It's just about understanding.
So you're saying that you're part of a growing culture of people who share information about salvage?
Not so much that. It's almost about figuring out the logistic of how something like that works. I mean, do you have a driver who's on call? Do you pay somebody to scour Craigslist every day?
Good question.
How do you do this?
How did you do it?
Well, I do have a driver who I just, I'll call him and be like, in front of Roberta's, there's a bunch of pallets, go get them. And the other Craigslist, but it requires a deeper thought process, which if you're building something, you've got enough to think about already. So it's one more thing you got to worry about. You can't, on Monday morning, you can't call up Lowe's and say, we need 100 sheetrocks by tomorrow morning. You've got to, 2 weeks before that, you've got to figure out where broken sheetrock is. Who's throwing up extra sheetrock that's broken and not usable.
That's a very interesting thing. What do you do with broken sheets of sheetrock? You must spend an enormous amount, go back to the financial thing, in taping.
You do. So that's the whole benchmarking thing of like, well, it's cost, let's say a sheet of sheetrock costs $10 just for the ease of calculation. And we get it for $2. Somebody sells it to us for $2. The corners are all broken.
Yeah.
And they can't sell it. So they're either going to throw it out or give it to us. Then it costs me $2 to do the driver. And then it costs an extra, so you do the math and you're doing this constant mental calculation as you're watching them tape it. And the alarm starts to go off when you see that it's costing you about $10. And at that point, you need to make a decision. Do I can it or not? And of course, I always make the decision to not can it, and we'll figure out how to do it.
Because cutouts, blowouts, bridging bits is tricky stuff.
It is tricky, but what's the alternative?
Now, is this a sales feature that works in your favor, that you're doing this?
Yes, it is. The clients who come to Eco Brooklyn almost always are clients who essentially just say, look, we want you. We haven't been able to find any other green builder that's really passionate about the ecology, and we're willing to spend a little bit more money if We feel like we're going to help save the planet ecologically.
I mean, because the stuff that I see going out in less extreme scenarios than what you're describing, I see sheets or cut up bits of sheets, and they're sized to fit in one of those, what is that, a half yard dumpster on wheels. And so you've got a piece that's maybe 30 inches and maybe it's 12 inches wide, and then you get another piece that's maybe 18 by 24. So you can end up with a whole patchwork of stuff. To accommodate that, do you put your studs and your partitions like at 12 inches on center?
No. What we try to do is we try to align ourselves with other... It's kind of like the trickle-down theory. So a building job site has a cycle, a life cycle. So
sure.
If you see them putting, let's say... sheetrock in the dumpster, you know that 2 weeks from now they're going to be putting scraps of flooring in the dumpster.
Right.
And then 2 weeks after that, they're going to start putting the RAM board flooring protection in the dumpster.
Right.
So if they are a multifamily unit of 12 apartments and you're doing a brownstone, their garbage, which is just a pain in their butt, is actually a gold mine for you, because it could literally be enough of what you need. So we try to align ourselves with larger jobs and figure out where their timing is.
And so you go to them and you say, instead of breaking up your leftover pieces, we'll take them whole. You don't have to put them in the dumpster.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you have laborers and cart that away.
Right. Uh-huh. Exactly. So we're just like, look, give us a call. You're going to save yourself dumpster fees. You're going to save yourself breaking the stuff up, and it seems to work. It seems to work. I mean, that's all I can say. It is working. I mean, we're doing it. We've just built a house, and it was, in terms of not counting the mechanicals, because anytime you go with energy efficiency stuff, the fridge, the windows, the boiler, we don't buy, we buy that new.
Well, we kind of have to.
There's too many advances.
To have the
efficiency.
Yeah, because older stuff,
yeah,
just a few years older, is not nearly as efficient. Yeah.
But everything else, it's just about aligning yourselves with bigger fish.
Yeah, except, yes. Now, I did want to talk about your triple glazed windows in terms of the comfort for the people using the house. Jack, can we have the next break, please?
I light the fire.
There's a song to comfort. I'm here, Curtis B. Wayne, Burning Down the House with Gennaro Brooks, Church of Eco, Brooklyn. And we're talking about comfort in his latest project up in Harlem, which has triple glazed pine framed windows from Austria. Kind of exotic.
Yeah, it did. I think it took 3 months for them to get here.
That's not so bad. You know, in larger projects, we try to anticipate a 6-month lead time for any major bunch of components. So that's, but that's a different scale.
Right.
So for 3 months, that's pretty long. It's not like ordering up an Anderson or an Eagle window.
Which would be like 3 weeks or something.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So tell me about these windows and why are they so great and what do they do for the people who are inhabiting this project?
Well, the energy savings, I'm told, I mean, this is calculations that I did once in the Passive House training and decided I'd never do it again. But
I'm not going to ask you why, but we could get
I'm just
later.
Not that kind of Excel sheet type. But the calculations pay for themselves. In these triple glazed windows are very expensive compared to, not compared to the architectural, because you can get more expensive in the architectural stuff. But if, in terms of, these are very simple looking windows. Mm-hmm. They're nothing fancy looking. I mean, well, they feel like bank vaults doors. They're very solid, but they look pretty basic. And so,
by the way, listeners, there are videos of Gennaro and his crew building this house on YouTube. If you Google Gennaro Harlem Eco Brooklyn, you'll find them, and they're very informative. You can see the windows coming off the truck, and there's this very Nordic looking guy explaining how painting a window is stupid. Is he Danish or German or Austrian or what?
Yeah, he's probably all three.
Okay. and I really don't want to get into paint a window, don't paint a window. Me, I would oil the window, but...
Me too.
I would do something to it, because wood dries out, and it bothers me, but I'd probably use teak oil or something like that. Anyway, what about the comfort inside? Triple glazing, we know... you know, from the architectural side, we know the triple glazing is really good for acoustical isolation. So these apartments must be very quiet.
They are, and that's between the floors as well, because we soundproof them. But in terms of comfort, the other thing to consider is that they're casement windows, so they're not double hung.
Right.
And casement windows, there's just less kind of linear footage of right. seams.
Yep. So there's half as much as a double hung.
Right.
Right.
So less cracks, less air infiltration. And it's very, you know, that kind of that image of a cat sleeping on the windowsill in the sun. There's just no heat loss. And
so there's no heat gain, so right. The cat's not going to be sleeping on a windowsill.
No.
Cat's going to be sleeping on the bedspread where it's nice and soft.
Exactly.
Aha. Uh-huh. But when you're... I have to say I haven't ever been in one of these projects. I expect I will be, you know, soon. I'd like to go up and see Chris Benedict's recently completed job in the Bronx, see what that's like.
Yeah.
Do people feel a difference in terms of interior air quality? Did you do anything for air filtration?
Well, we did a tremendous amount. And in short, there were two things we focused on. One is just reducing or eliminating chemicals. And the other one was in terms of the buildup of just CO2 and formaldehyde and all these things that our bodies give off.
Yeah.
We have a very tight house, which it doesn't breathe. Which would literally just become insufferable if we didn't ventilate it somehow. So,
right.
But the problem with ventilating it in the wintertime, you bring in cold air, you got to heat it, that's a problem. So what everybody uses are essentially heat recovery ventilators or energy recovery ventilators.
Yeah.
And in this climate, energy recovery ventilators are good because energy recovery ventilators take out humidity, which is a good thing for... It reverses itself. In the wintertime, the cold, dry air coming in gets some of the humidity from the stale, more humid air going out.
Right.
It passes the humidity over, and the cold air gets heated by the hot air going out. So
you're recovering humidity.
Your energy, yeah.
So your ventilator reverses itself? It traps humidity and then blows it back in.
Exactly. What it does is in the winter time you've got fresh air that's almost the same warmth as room temperature, and almost the same humidity.
Wow.
Which is just it's really phenomenal living in. My house is built along passive house standards, and I have a very good system. It's a Zender system, and the freshness in the wintertime is noticeable. The flip side, in the summertime, you've got hot humid air coming in, and then you've got cooler, less humid air going out, and it just flips around. And it does the reverse.
So you have a little more humidity in the summer than somebody who's got the AC blasting all the time.
It would be more humid than that, and it's not going to heat or cool your house per se. I mean, you need
But humidity is a factor in our comfort in the summertime.
Our perception of heat.
Yeah, yes, very much. Yes, so, yeah. Right. I mean, it could be 80 degrees, but if the humidity is low, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
But that sounds good. I mean, I work in a fairly green environment, but I notice that humidity control is a major problem. I mean, I wear contacts, and whether it's in the heating cycle or the cooling cycle, humidity is just not high enough. Both systems seem to suck it out.
Yeah, that's very true. That's a problem with the current system. It's like overventilating your environment.
Yeah.
Just one other thing, in terms of humidity, we put clay on the party walls.
Yeah.
And we did that because you need to seal the wall so air doesn't breathe through it. But also, we could have done it with, Stoggard or any other toxic petrochemical.
What's Stoggard?
It's a fancy paint, basically.
That bituminous stuff.
Yeah, it's petrochemical based.
Right. Which we use to waterproof basements, or sometimes there's a layer under EFIS.
Yeah, exactly.
For lay people, that's exterior insulated finish system. It's a cheap shit kind of stucco system that goes over foam insulation. Jack, let's take five and then see where we go. Okay, well, that wasn't five, but it was Dave Brubeck here with Gennaro. Gennaro was just about to tell me about plastering the sidewalls in this project.
One of the
party walls.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm really into is going, just looking at things that have worked for like thousands of years, and
I'm down with that.
Since the 50s, all of a sudden we threw all that stuff out, right?
It just wasn't scientific, man.
No, it wasn't plastic, and that was the future. So that's really interesting to me. So with this one, again, I was like, okay, great. So normal passive houses have been done with Stoggard or some other sort of kind of paint product, sealer, varnish. It's like, okay, well, that's not interesting to me. So what could we use and synergize with some of the other things? And clay was a very obvious answer.
Well, clay's second cousin to a plaster finish. You could have done a three-coat scratch, brown scratch and finish coat plaster, which would have been really impervious.
Yes.
But that's very labor-intensive.
It is. And also the heat required to make that stuff.
Well, that's true. Heat it. That's right.
So whereas with clay, you're literally just digging it out of the ground.
Right.
And presto, you're done.
Right. And I suppose in the big picture, when we run out of clay, it's time to move to Mars or get on a starship and go someplace else.
Right.
But clay can be recycled.
Yeah, and my suspicion is that we're going to run out of other things many hundreds of years before we run out of clay.
and you just never know. 40 years ago, when I was in architecture school, they were telling us that we'd run out of gypsum by the 1990s, and we should be thinking about other materials we could use, maybe oil-based materials, because the worldwide supply of gypsum was going to run out, and so plaster or even drywall was just not going to be available. And then, you know, the understanding of what was possible. There'll probably be massive mining of garbage dumps to reclaim gypsum and reprocess it, you know, late in this century or early next. I mean, that's a Bucky Fuller thing, that garbage dumps are the mines of the future.
Yeah.
Any other things you want to talk about as we just dwindle down in our allotted time here?
No, it's been great. I mean, speaking of gypsum, I hate sheetrock. It's just, it bugs the hell out of me. And just today I salvaged some homosote, and because I needed it for soundproofing. I'm building a yoga studio. And
that's a dense cardboard like material. You can stick push pins into it. It has a slight amount of acoustical quality in terms of absorption. We used lots of it when we were in architecture school as cladding for the studio walls. It's right. Lovely stuff.
Yeah, and it works like sheetrock. It's not as strong, but you could paint it and it looked like a white wall. And
it's just those joints are really tough to meld together.
Yeah, you're gonna.
If you don't mind seeing the joints, it's fine. Yeah. Or if your aesthetic allows you to use battens over the joints,
right?
You could do that.
Yeah.
Homosote's good, and you can make it out of almost anything. You can make it out of shredded rags, cellulose, lots of cellulose. But it doesn't have a particularly good flame spread rating. So
no.
You're kind of limited to small projects if you're using that.
Yeah.
So what projects are on the horizon for you?
Well, right now we're doing a yoga studio spa. We're using insane experimentation with soundproofing. And the other thing about it is that there's going to be a lot of living walls within the studio that'll be fed by the use of water that the spa will use. So we have an unlimited amount of water, gray water, that allows us to make some really lush living walls. So that's really
inside the studio.
Inside the studio. So it's something going to be kind of Patrick Blanc style, you know.
Wow.
He's a...
I'm really myself. I'm particularly interested in acoustics. So, what mad levels of acoustic treatment are you getting into?
Well, we're.
I don't think of yoga as a very loud kind of environment.
No, but when you have a shoe store with loud music underneath it, right,
right.
But also, don't forget, you've got right at the end of the yoga class, you've got the meditation, and then you've got 20 people showing up for the next class. Yeah, but it's just very subtle things trying to attack the three different levels of sound. It gets pretty technical.
So isolating yourself from the structure below.
Isolating yourself from everything. So all walls are isolated from the other walls. And
wow, so everything's sort of sprung.
Everything's floating on salvaged carpeting or foam, or it's got green glue, and I've actually don't tell anybody, but I'm using mass loaded vinyl, which is basically PVC, and which is horrible stuff. But I wanted to use it just to see what it's like, because people swear by it, so I want to see how good of a deadener it is for sound.
You'll have to invite me to come and have a look. I'd love to see it. I'd actually love to see it during construction.
Yes, you should come by.
Is it ongoing?
Yes. Well, it will be done in about a month. So
I'll shoot you an email.
Okay.
I'd like to come and see how the detailing is working out for you. I won't ask you where it is. Before we go, listeners, remember that HRN is saluting hosts this coming Wednesday, March 21st, at the Santos Party House. Go to our website, click on the link, buy a ticket, come and hang with us. Come and hang with me. You know, I'm actually kind of fun in a party environment. It's not all serious, pointed questions all the time. Come and hang with Patrick Martins and Jack Inslee, our executive producer and engineer. Come and hang out with the glamorous Katie Kiefer and our chef, Erica Wides. Compare mixology recipes with Dave Arnold. Dave's going to be there, right? Yes?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, cool. Talk beer with Jimmy Carboni. Come and talk natural history with Ernie Wides. I mean, we're all going to be there. Come and show your support for this fantastic experiment in community-based global reach radio on the Internet Heritage Radio Network. Thank you, Gennaro, for joining us. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.